This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. One of the big science stories this year was actually a retracted paper. You might remember the study that said gay and lesbian canvassers could influence voters just by talking to them face to face. Might be true, might not. We don't know, because it turns out the researchers made up the data. And the fabrication was only found out when other researchers tried to reproduce the study and failed. A team of researchers decide to put science to the test and just see how many studies could be replicated. That's what they did. Well, if this the kind of paper is a failure, how many other papers are like that? They looked at lots of psychological studies, and their success rate was not so good. They were only able to reproduce the original results half the time. The failures in those studies were due to fraud, but they weren't due to fraud, but to what scientists have been calling the reproducibility problem. Never heard of that. The reproducibility problem. Is this a sign of a breakdown in science, or is this part of the process? That's what we're going to be talking about. If you'd like to join our discussion, 844-SCI-TALK, 844-724-8255. You can tweet us at SciFry. Let me introduce my guest. Brian Nosek is executive director at the Center for Open Science, the group that conducted this replication study. He's also professor of psychology at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville, Virginia. Welcome, Dr. Nosek.
Thanks for having me on.
We've always heard that replicating results is one of the, you know, the fundamentals of validating research, but it looks like that's easier said than done. How did your group replicate these studies?
Well, what we did was we defined a sample of studies from three journals in our field that are important journals, and then we reached out to the original authors, asked them for their materials so that we could do as good a job as we could reproducing how it is they did the research. We drafted protocols for each of those replications and then sent those to the original authors for feedback and for others independently to give feedback. Then we pre-registered those designs and analysis plans on the Open Science framework so that others could scrutinize what we were doing while we did it. And then we conducted the studies, a number of different independent groups, 270 co-authors in all.
Why is it so difficult to reproduce what was originally done?
Well, there's a few reasons that reproducibility may be low. One of them is that science is hard. We are investigating questions and topics where we are at the boundaries of knowledge and we don't have a clear sense of when things will and will not occur. And so it's hard to get those results multiple times while we're still investigating, exploring, discovering things about the phenomenon.
Did you want to continue?
There's another way to frame it, which is there are three different possibilities to understand why original studies got a result and the replication studies didn't get the same result. One is that the original result was false in some way, right? It was a false mm-hmm. positive. It detected an effect that wasn't really there. A second possibility is that it was the replication is a false negative. It failed to detect that original effect, even though it's there, just via chance. But the third possibility is the real interesting one, which is both of them are correct in some way, but they differ in some fundamental parts, a different sample, a different setting, a different nuances in the procedures that cause the difference between the original and the replication. But the challenge in science is trying to figure out, hypothesize what that might be. What are the differences that might explain why these differed? And then do new studies to try to accumulate more evidence for those explanations.
Can you give us an example of a study that didn't replicate? What didn't match up in the original versus the replicated study?
Well, there are a number of studies. I'll give an example of my own. I had one of the studies that was in the pool to be replicated. And what we had done in the original research was find that people would learn about one person, learn that they've done some bad things, and then they would learn that there is a new person in a different group, in the same group, but they don't know anything about that second person. And when you ask people, how do you feel about the second person, they say, well, I don't know. I don't know anything about that person. They don't use the information about person A to generalize about person B because that would be stereotyping. But implicitly, they do that. They transfer the information they learned about person A to person B because they're in the same group. And we found that that occurred, and then it generalized to our conscious feelings after a few days when you forget who it was that did what. Well, the replication tried to reproduce that finding, and it reproduced parts of it, but the key test that was the target for replication didn't show the same result.
And you have any explanation for that?
Well, right now we don't, other than it's possible that both of them or the average between the two is the more correct answer between them. So this is really one of the key pieces of insight, and although it's not a new insight, from the results of this research, which is no study is definitive. That first study provided some evidence about the phenomenon. The replication provides additional evidence. And in aggregate, they provide even more evidence. And so really, science as a process is a process of uncertainty reduction. Our models of how the world works are incomplete. We are wrong about everything in some fundamental way. And so what science does to make progress is to figure out where we're wrong and become less wrong over time. Mm-hmm. And so that accumulation of evidence across many studies is really where we arrive at a conclusion, rather than thinking that the first time we investigate something, we've discovered the conclusion straight off.
Do you think that the results of these studies is true for all the sciences, not just psychology, but chemistry, physics, whatever?
Yeah, it's a good question. And in one way, we don't know, because this is the first study that's done a reproducibility effort in a systematic way like this, although there's lots of hints that there are reproducibility challenges across the sciences. And the reason for that is that the incentives for success in science are not necessarily aligned with maximizing or improving reproducibility. So how I succeed and the members of my lab succeed in science is publication. And so we have to produce results that maximize the likelihood of publishing, being able to publish those results and to publish them in prestigious outlets if we can. But not everything gets published. You're more likely to get a result published if it's a positive result that shows a relationship rather than no relationship. You're more likely to publish if it's a novel result, something that people hadn't thought about before or hadn't observed before. And you're more likely to get published if it's a clean story, that you can put all of the pieces together and show that you have a clear understanding of that phenomenon.
Is there some hesitance for journals to publish reproduced studies? I mean, are they looking for original work, even if this one doesn't work?
Yeah, and that has both human and competitive tendencies behind that, right? The competitive tendency is journals want to survive and thrive as well. And so novel, positive, clean results are better results. It is great when we get those. The challenge is that we very rarely get those. Mm-hmm. And the reason is because we're studying stuff we don't understand. It is a mess. We are trying to put things together. We have a difficult time explaining what it is we're investigating. That's why we're studying it. We don't study things that we know well, because what's the point? And so the mess that's in the sort of the lab of what we're trying to do and how we're trying to figure out isn't incentivized when we're putting it out into a report. And so that can create reproducibility challenges. The published literature may be more beautiful than reality.
Do you think that your follow-up study here, your published study, gives a black eye to science?
I hope it doesn't. It certainly presents a challenge, and that is that the rate of reproducibility we observed in this study is probably lower than many would expect, or at least many would hope for, that we presume when we see published literature that we know inside that some of it isn't going to reproduce easily, but we presume that probably more of it does. But the positive of this is that it was a self-study, right? This were a group of psychologists got together, volunteered their time to contribute to trying to investigate their own discipline to identify challenges for reproducibility. And then once we have now some empirical evidence, that gives some basis for the initiatives to try to improve reproducibility. Mm-hmm. And psychology has been one of those fields that's both been looking at itself self-critically and also pursuing a lot of innovative progressive initiatives to try to increase reproducibility in the research that it publishes.
I want to bring on another guest to talk about the impact of all of this irreproducibility. Leonard Friedman is president of the Global Biological Standards Institute based in Washington. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks, Ira. I'm a very big fan of the show. I've been listening to it for years.
Oh, thank you. Your study looked at preclinical research. You put a price on all this irreproducible research. $28 billion. Tell us how you arrived at that figure and what was involved in preclinical research.
Yeah, so I know it's an eye-popping number. And we wanted to calculate really the economic costs of exactly what Brian Nosek has been discussing, albeit we focused on preclinical, that is basic research in the biomedical arena, where I think there are lots of parallels to what Brian has described in the social sciences. And to do that, we teamed up with two Boston University economists. I'm not an economist myself. I'm a molecular biologist, Tim Simcoe and Ian Cockburn. And these guys actually had studied for several years the impact of standards and best practices in different industries, such as electronics, shipping, telecommunications. There really is no very good set of studies certainly in biomedical research along the same lines. So we had to do sort of a bottom-up analysis and a top-down analysis to come up with this number. I don't really want to get into the gory details here, but in the bottom-up analysis, we identified four major categories that we think are major contributors to irreproducibility, at least in biomedical research. And they are study design, biological reagents and reference materials, lab protocols, and data analysis and reporting. Some of these overlap, I think, very well with the social sciences. Some of them, like reagents and reference materials, don't. We estimated flaws and errors in each of those areas and came up with prevalence values. And there are limitations to this study with, you know, a low end, a high end, and a midpoint. The midpoint was 53%, which is actually quite close to Brian's recently, like yesterday, published 60% irreproducibility rate.
And how much of this is, if I was listening to the factors, it sounds a lot like a lot of it is human error in either reading the data, analyzing the data.
That's right. That's right. And so we think that there are opportunities here, you know, like you were discussing with Brian Nosek. There is a sort of negativity to these kinds of numbers, $28 billion that have been spent on irreproducible research is a pretty sobering kind of message. But we also think that there are opportunities here where we can identify areas where there can be substantial improvement.
So are we talking about sloppy science, just sloppy data collection and analysis? Because that's what it sounds like.
It does sound like that, but it isn't quite that, because researchers can be doing exemplary work and nonetheless end up with an irreproducible result. And that's primarily because of uncertainty, of having to make inferences from incomplete information. Sorry, Len, to interrupt. I'm sure you have other thoughts on that, too.
No, I mean, I agree with that. But I also think that there are opportunities in terms of, again, in the biomedical realm, there are issues with the application of poor reagents, for example. There's a whole controversy around misidentified cell lines that cell biologists and molecular biologists use, even though there are straightforward assays where one can identify or authenticate those cell lines. There are issues with reagents such as research antibodies, which are very, very poorly characterized. And anybody who's worked in a lab can tell you they've had that experience where they think they're using an antibody that will give them a quality result, and it doesn't. So I think that, although, as Brian was saying, there's also a very profound cultural component to this, including the kinds of perverse incentives that Brian was alluding to. Mm-hmm. I think that there are opportunities where modest investments. So when we say $28 billion is applied to irreproducible research, we're not advocating that that amount should be, for example, cut from the research budget. We're actually advocating that with modest investments, we can correct some of these flaws, not all of them, and get tremendous returns on investment.
I've got to remind everybody that this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking about irreproducible events. There's a comedy magazine, it's Science Magazine, I think. Also has that as its sort of like its title. Let me go to the phones. Our phone number is 844-724-8255. Let's go to Duncan in Rochester, New York. Hi, Duncan.
How are you?
Hey there.
I'd like to give another example of where reproducible results occur within your own organization. About 20 years ago, I make an optical material in glass, and we were transitioning it to production. And when we started producing it in January, we had no problems with production until all of a sudden, using the same processes in July, it didn't work. It took us about 3 months to figure out what's going on. It turns out it was the humidity change in Rochester. Another example occurred to us about a year ago when we were doing some stuff in polymer work, and the supplier of one of our polymers changed one of the components in the polymer without telling us. And suddenly a process that had been very stable was completely unstable. And so sometimes, even with your own research group, you can have irreproducible results.
That's interesting. All right. Thanks for calling. That's quite interesting. Brian, how are our journals beginning to address this problem?
There's a number of new initiatives that journals are pursuing. One of them is called the TOP guidelines, Transparency and Openness Promotion. And there are more than 500 journals that have added themselves as signatories to this, which means that they're going to investigate adoption of a number of different standards, data transparency, methods and materials transparency, a lot of the things like Len was describing, making sure it's clear which reagents were used, whether validation was done on those reagents or antibodies, and then also pre-registration of research designs and incentives for replication. Another thing that a number of journals are trying is called registered reports, and there are 16 journals that are doing this now, where peer review is done prior to knowing the results of the study. In most research now, we do the studies in our lab, we write up the report, and we submit it. And all the incentives are driving towards making those results as beautiful as possible to get through peer review when it's submitted to the journal. But with doing peer review in advance of knowing the results, the incentives are for making sure that your question is the most important and best framed question possible, and that your methodology is the strongest possible to test that question.
All right.
And that's the basis of publication.
All right. We've run out of time. I'd like to thank my guests, Brian Nosek, Executive Director at the Center for Open Science, Professor of Psychology, University of Virginia, Charlottesville, Leonard Friedman, President of the Global Biological Standards Institute based in Washington. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today.